one of the great scholars of the 17th century was a man named Rav Yom Tov Liebman Heller. And although we consider that persecution was the main enemy of the Jews in the Middle Ages, when you actually read the chronicles of Jews in the Middle Ages, you realize that plague was at least as great a threat as persecution, and more pitiless in some ways. As the chief rabbi of Prague, which he was for a while, Rabbi Heller survived the Great Plague of 1625 and addressed the question of whether he should give public thanks for having survived the plague. And he took the position, as explained in a recent biography of him, that one ought not to give thanks for a miracle that brings with it a disaster. And so, although he could be personally grateful, he would not come before the congregation and give thanks because so many had died. The question that Rabbi Heller addressed in his own life, which is the question of the intertwining between miracles and tragedies, is well known to us. It is not only well known to us because every tragedy seems to carry with it stories of those who miraculously survive, but also because, and in a more paradoxical and difficult way, sometimes the miracle and the tragedy are the same. And that brings us to modern medicine. The advance of medicine, especially towards the end of the 20th and 21st century, is a miracle. Before the advent of the 20th century, when you went to a doctor, the chances were more than 50% that the doctor would harm you rather than help you. Between then and now is an almost unimaginable distance. But every advance brings with it the potential for tragedy. And this drama that has riveted the country of a woman who is being fed through a tube, who 50 years ago would have passed away, forces us to ask whether in this case it's a miracle or a tragedy, or maybe a little bit of both. Before I address other parts of this question, I want to explain the Jewish halachic view, the Jewish legal view, and what makes it so difficult. Because according to the Jewish tradition, you are allowed to cease what are called extraordinary means. If somebody shows virtually no signs of life, but they're on a heart-lung machine, you may take them off the heart-lung machine. That's clearly considered unusual measures. And in fact, this comes from several sources, but one of the sources is that extraordinary story in the Talmud of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, one of the greatest of the Talmudic rabbis, who was dying and was kept alive by the prayers of his students who gathered around his house and prayed for him nonstop that he should live and he shouldn't die. And when his housekeeper saw the pain that he endured day after day, and that there was this tug of war between heaven and earth, between God who was prepared to take his soul and his students who were unprepared to release his soul, She climbed to the roof of the house, she took a jar and threw it down, and it smashed on the ground, and for an instant, the students, startled, stopped praying, and his soul was taken. The Talmud praises her. And so, based on that, and one or two other sources, the rabbis conclude that you may, in fact, cease a life support under certain circumstances. The question is whether a feeding tube is an extraordinary measure. Is it considered medicinal or purely nourishment? Those who consider it medicinal say, well, it has to be inserted and it has to be monitored and it's clearly a medical procedure. And the ones who consider it nourishment say, but it's food. And where you fall out Jewishly on this depends upon your view of the nature of the intervention. But that is only the beginning of the question. I'm not going to discuss the motives of the various participants, because that has been a long and unworthy and ugly discussion. Nobody knows what is in the mind of her husband. We cannot know. One day someone will say, aha, he has an insurance policy, and the next day someone will say, but he was offered twice, three times the insurance policy if he would give up his rights. All of these are externals. And we are often enough unsure of our own motives. How can we possibly know the motives of somebody in such a situation whom we have never met? I'm not even going to talk about, although this would make, I confess, an interesting sermon in its own right, why this has become such a cause célèbre. And also why, I predict with virtual certainty, nobody will think about it in 6 months. Just like 6 months ago's cause célèbre, which nobody remembers now. Instead, I want to ask, first of all, who makes the decision? Because no one has a monopoly on ethical knowledge. Not doctors, not philosophers, not rabbis, not priests, not ministers, not politicians, not even family members. And the answer is, and there is an answer, ideally, the decision is made by the patient. And it is made before the patient is unable to make a decision. There is something called a living will, in which you specify in writing and have notarized what you want done and who you want to make the decisions on your behalf if you can't make decisions on your own behalf. We have copies of such a will in my office, prepared by the rabbinical assembly, and everybody, once they come into the age of majority, when they are no longer under the aegis of their parents' responsibility, everybody should fill out such a will, but of course we don't. The other day, I came across an essay by one of my favorite essayists, William Hazlitt, who is a 19th century English writer, and I'm going to abbreviate the first paragraph because it is hard enough to listen to someone read something, to listen to somebody read a 19th century essay. It's no easy thing. But here is what he wrote. Few things show the human character in a more ridiculous light than the circumstances of will-making. We put it off as long as we can, and then we use every precaution to make sure the world will not gain by our death. The last act of our lives is characterized by stupidity, caprice, and spite. All that we seem to think of is to manage things so as to do as little good and to plague and disappoint as many people as possible. And that is exactly what we do with our fear of facing our own deaths, so we don't make arrangements for burial. We don't make arrangements for what happens if we are caught in a medical situation similar to the ones of Terry Schiavo. And we don't make arrangements for the disposition of our property that is unambiguous enough so that our heirs won't constantly fight. The goodness that we claim in our lives collapses after our death, all because of our unwillingness to admit that we will die. If there is nothing else that people take out of this tragedy, if it inspires them to put in writing what it is they want, thereby preventing a great deal of suffering for those whom we love, this will have had at least one very positive result. I am going to make available those same living wills not only in my office but also in the front office. We are happy to order more, and I hope that all of you will take advantage of them. Remember, these decisions are going to get more difficult, not less difficult. As medical technology advances, it pushes the border of survival further and further and further. And that means that people who could never survive today will survive next month, next year, and in 10 years. And the question is, will they want to? And will they make the decision for themselves, or will it be made for them by an often silent consortium of doctors, insurance companies, and sometimes family members? A lot of this comes down to the question of the dignity of a human being. And about this, I think as Jews in particular, we ought to be sensitive to something that is characteristic of our tradition. I am aware of the fact that at many Jewish funerals, before the service, the families will view the body. But you should know that it is against Jewish custom and against Jewish law. And there is a very good reason for that. People will say, it's important for me, for my peace of mind, to see him before he's buried. And I understand that. But the reason it's against Jewish law isn't because of you, it's because of him. It's called loeg larash, to mock one who is weak. It's the same reason that you are not allowed to wear tefillin in a graveyard, because you are around people who can't wear tefillin. And it's as if you are lording your power over them. I decide whether I can see him or not. He can't see me, but I decide whether I can see him. You're not allowed to do that. That is still lying in that coffin, the image of a human being, and therefore the image of God. And I must say that the assault, and it is nothing less than an assault, from newspapers and magazines and television, that pictures Terry Schiavo over and over and over again is a disgrace and a humiliation. I cannot know what it is that this woman would want, but she wouldn't want this. She wouldn't want to be seen that way. I know that because there is no human being on earth who would want to be seen that way, over and over and over again, by millions of people who never knew her when she was vital. We ought not to assume that we have that right. We don't. And it's a shame that somebody in her family didn't say to the cameras, no. And then finally, there is the deepest issue. Because this is not ultimately about a feeding tube. And it is not even ultimately about the regulatory system that we put in place to decide who makes these medical decisions. It's really about our attitude towards life and death. And here, the Jewish tradition is at odds with itself. As I believe it should be. First of all, we believe passionately, irrevocably, unendingly in the sanctity of life and the need to preserve it. Ubacharta v'chayim, you shall choose life, we are told. It's a choice, but we're commanded to make it. So we do believe that virtually at all costs, you have to make sure that life is preserved, and yet at the same time, death is not the worst thing that can happen to a human being. It's just not. Not in our tradition. The worst thing that can happen to a human being is to be far from God. And death does not separate you from God. And so there is this combat. The death of someone we love is a tragedy for us, but it's not a tragedy for them. We may mourn the years that they didn't get to enjoy this earth, but if our tradition is telling us the truth, since this is not the only world in which human beings live in a way we don't understand and cannot imagine, even mourning their lost years is more a pain for us than for them. And so seeing somebody who is living a life that is not a life, I am struck by this contradiction. And I have been spending the last week trying to find or to think of something that wraps up the contradiction and helps us understand it in a way that expresses the true Jewish attitude toward life and death. As some of you know, I am supposed to speak tomorrow night on CNN at 8 o'clock about the Schiavo case and about suffering. And although I won't have time to read this poem, if I did, I would. because this is what we believe. It was written by an Israeli, well, a Hebrew writer. He was not born in Israel. He was born in Eastern Europe. He was a mystic, a chassid, also an Enlightenment writer. He crossed religious boundaries within Judaism a great deal in his life. He was a fascinating man, and his name was Hillel Bavli. And he wrote a poem called "This Is My Prayer," Tfilati. This is my prayer to you, O God. Let not my spirit wither and shrivel in its thirst for you and lose the dew with which you sprinkled it when I was young. May my heart be open to every broken soul, to orphaned life, to every stumbler wandering unknown and groping in the shadow. Bless my eyes. Purify me to see humanity's beauty rise in this world and the glory of my people in its redeemed land, spreading its fragrance throughout the earth. Deepen and broaden my senses to absorb a fresh, green, flowering world, to take from it the secret of blossoming in silence. Grant strength to yield fine fruit, quintessence of my life, steeped in my very being without expectation of reward. This is someone who loved life and wanted to extract from it everything he could. And this is the last paragraph of his poem. And when my time comes, let me slip into the night, demanding nothing, God, of humanity or of you. We are commanded to live, but only as long as there is life. And when our time comes, may we be blessed to slip into the night, not needing to demand anything of each other or of God. Amen.